Good evening. At this time, K2KEY, Mel, K2RIW, Dick, run a thing called the TechNet. The major purpose of that TechNet is to bring the clan together, to help each other, to learn more about the 26 or 25 different kinds of ham radio. People sign in, give us their call letters, their name, and give us a yes, which means if you have a question or a comment for the net. The net is primarily a verbal, live question and answer session. Yes, we do offer a written service, but that's a minor function, the secondary function. And a person who writes in a question, with a few exceptions, is at a considerable risk. He might not get an answer. There's no promises. We promise to give as best answers we can verbally to the live question and answer session, and there's no promises on the written one. So please recognize that. This is not a free consulting service that you're going to get a written question and answer from. This is not a free kind of consulting service where we do a marketing survey and list for you all the kinds of ham radio rig you can buy that are brand new and which ones you should buy and which one's the best price, antennas and feed lines. We don't do that. We don't do marketing surveys for you. So we got to make that sort of clear up front. There are people who have misunderstood the real motivation of the TechNet. It's a live question and answer period of the people who gather here, and an awful lot of the information doesn't come from Mel and I. It comes from the people who have got the specific knowledge in those particular areas. So once again, a person signs in by giving us your call letters and name. A typical sign-in would sound like this. N2NNU, Alex, and yes. But do we have any questions? Check-ins. Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW, my name is Dick, and we're listening.
N2EO, Rich, and yes.
With traffic.
Okay, Rich recognized. Someone said with traffic. Who was that?
W2OY,
Joe. W2OY, Joe. Yes.
CRP, no.
Hey, Joe.
Okay, we had a bunch of quadruples. And there's somebody in signing in three times in a row with no audio. So far, we've got Rich, Bob, and Joe. Give me your call letters one at a time.
W2TRP, no.
Len, no.
No.
WB2ZHB, no.
KC2MDP, Steve, and no question.
N2RSO, Frank, no.
KC2EFR, Mitchell, no.
W2TRP, Irwin, no.
WB2CUK, Bill, no, just listening.
Good evening, K2KEY.
K2T, Joe, no.
And WS2N with yes.
I noticed that the audio, there we go, the audio is back to normal. Of the guesses so far, Rich, Bob, Joe, and Paul, in that order, of the yeses. And Bubble Bright and Irwin signed in. Got a couple more words to say to Irwin on the subject of the oil burner service. Let's start off with Rich. N2EO, what's happening in Whitestone? Yeah, I think it's Whitestone is where you live. Go ahead, Rich, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, yeah, Whitestone, not White Plains, Whitestone. Okay, Dick, my question, I guess, is on restoration. You know, I'm into this Collins restoration and restoration of a lot of the antique gear. Cosmetics is as important to me as at the same website. And I want to know if anybody had any information. I'm going to look on the internet, but I figured I would get some preliminary information here on silk screening. Silk screening of front panels, meter faces, those two things in particular. Because a lot of these radios, the front has to be redone. I have, for instance, here I just restored a Central Electronics Q multiplier from the mid 50s. The front panel was in reasonably good shape. I was able to touch it up. But what would be a lot nicer is if I could spray it and then re-silk screen it. And I'm wondering, the meter faces, what do they use? Because right now I've done some meter faces, as you know, by scanning the image on a computer, making a printout on photographic paper, and pasting it with Elmer's glue over the original. I would like eventually to be able to either use a printer, I think there's something called a plotter, I don't know much about it, to actually reconstruct with ink or paint the original face on some of these meters. Also, like I say, the front panel on Johnson Viking Ranger, Collins equipment. Spraying it and matching the paint is no problem. I can use an airbrush, the paint is available. Collins still has the paint, or actually it's available from the Klinger Paint Company in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. The colors are still available, but the problem is getting the lettering back. Over to you, Dick, K2RIW, TechNet, Weimark, and 2EO.
Yeah, it sounds like you're getting quite heavy into the restoration of those pieces of Collins and Central Electronics equipment. I've done some very high resolution. In my day, I thought it was high resolution plotting, XY plotting, on a Hewlett-Packard plotter in order to make very elaborate three-dimensional antenna patterns, which are called hidden light programming. Nowadays, a modern-day inkjet printer, I think, has higher resolution, much greater color capability. You choose the right kind of printing paper. You go to your supply house where you can buy special glossy printed paper, printing paper, which will give you the equivalent of a photograph off of the inkjet printer, which really, in my opinion, in both color, saturation, resolution, and whatever, it really challenges what Kodak used to be able to do with color printing paper. So with the right program or with the right, scanning function, if you can get an original, in the case of meter movements I'm speaking now, if you can get the original meter movement by some means, scan it, and then make a photocopy by way of an inkjet printer, I think that would make you an awful fine reproduction that could be then glued onto the meter movement face inside the glass. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing now. I'm using photographic paper. I'm scanning them. Using Adobe Photoshop to enhance them and printing them out. I'd like to take it a step further and actually print or silk screen, I'm not sure how to do it, on the actual metal. Either turn it over, repaint the other side, and put the scale on the other side, or use the original side, make it just like the factory. Any thoughts?
I have a suggestion.
Okay, a person who said that I have a suggestion, could you give us your call letters, your name, and then proceed with your suggestion? My name is Dick.
Wow, what's wrong with me? You didn't recognize my voice, Dick. This is Antoine Neal. Can I proceed with this?
You sure can, Alex. And you said so few words that I didn't get quite enough to recognize you. Alex, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. For what it's worth it, I do the front panels I need with the PCB layout program. In other words, I lay out the printed circuit board, well, the face panel as a printed circuit board with everything that has to be written, whatnot. Lines, you can make a fine line up to 1 mil on it. And then you produce, out of that, you produce a file type, of type Gerber. and that is sent then to a printed circuit board manufacturer that he can put that on a PCB, your design. The PCB thickness can be anything you want, from 1 mil to 100 mils. So they self-screen and they make all the holes and whatnot, all automatically, probably for $20-$30 a piece. That's my suggestion.
So, if I understand you correctly, once you create, by way of your various programs, a Gerber file, which gives exact dimensions of what you want laid down where, if I understand you correctly, Alex, you then take the real metallic front face of the meter, the piece of metal that normally has the markings on it. I think you're saying you're mailing that piece of metal, or you're having them make a similar piece. Maybe you're having them make a printed circuit board that has the exact same thickness that you screw in where the metal piece normally goes. And then can they lay that out with just the same white background that Rich has right now, with the black lettering on top of it, for instance, and maybe some colors? Do you believe that they could do it in such a way that he could screw it in as if it was the piece of metal that's there now? Back to you, Alex.
Well, not that I believe. I know that I can do it. It's a matter of specifications. Exactly, but you don't do it on metal. You do it on printed circuit board, a single lamination or a double lamination, whatever, bottom on top or on only one on the top. You can do it even without the copper on it. It's a matter of specification. The beauty of it is sending only the file to the manufacturer, and the manufacturer returns the hardware, the piece of fiberglass or fiberglass with copper on it or whatnot, with an exact replica of what you have designed into the printed circuit board program. The second beauty is that the precision of it is extremely high. You can go to a grid of, actually gridless, but I'm using a 1 mil grid, and that is best for everything I do that. Back to you, Dick. Dick, he misunderstands. He thinks you're making a PC board.
No, I don't think Alex is misunderstanding. I have seen printed circuit boards, and I'm going to pick up Eric in a minute. I have seen printed circuit boards, Rich, where although underneath the paint there is a real printed circuit board with multiple layers to it, holes and plated through holes and places where the components go down, on top of the board I have seen typically a green paint with white lettering, indicating the green paint insulates the copper upper surface most of the places. The white lettering indicates where components go. So whether you're laying out a printed circuit board with that kind of marking, and maybe in your particular case you're going to request a white background instead of a green background, with black lettering instead of white lettering. So they could make you a 32nd of an inch thick double-sided printed circuit board where the board itself has no real cutout and no plated through holes, or there could be plated through holes where the screws go. And the painting that goes on top that indicates the labeling, the brand name, the circuit board model number, and the component layout and the component labeling for C3 and Q5 and TR41 and so on, that's just whether they're marking it out for components on a board or whether it's the markings for a meter movement. With the high precision with which they can do that, I think Alex is onto something here. Let's see what Eric has to say on all this. KE2EJ, how do you do it, Eric? K2RIW, in the second half.
Hi, Dick. K2RIW, KE2EJ. Now, if you want to spend a couple of dollars, there are now about 5 internet companies that will etch panel plates, etch meter plates for you. It's basically aluminum with a white paint, with an etch, with black fill. I think one of them's called etching-metal.com. They pretty much etch anything. I make my own PC boards, and lately I've been making my own plated through holes. That's a real trick. I like that. But if you want to go the cheap way, there's a number of materials that you can put through a laser printer. And by using thermal transfer, you can actually print on this material. I have some of it yet. What's the name of it? Let me find it for you. You can buy it from DigiKey. You can buy it from a number of things.
They have something called white TRF and green TRF. Works with a laser printer, but I believe they now have materials that work with inkjets, too. Oh, and as far as photographic processes go, you can actually, if you're really into etching and you want to be really good about it, you can get from Rockwell Industries, also, what's the name of their company? Injectorol. They have spray emulsions that you can spray on the on any surface that you want, and you make yourself, you come to either negative or positive. You can expose it with UV light or fluorescent bulbs, which is a good source of UV light, and make your exposure and develop it. It's basically a sodium hydroxide solution. And then etch it in ferric chloride if you're dealing with copper. There are other materials that you can use for etching aluminum, sodium persulfate. I tend to like to use persulfate, it's very slow, but when I'm doing PC boards, I use ferric chloride kind of fast, because the slower you go, the little more creepiness you get in your the mass that you lay down. Let me get a drop. The ferric chloride works better. The only thing is, you really want to run it at about 125 degrees, because it's not very active when it's cold. It's a good temperature. You should bubble air through the solution. It takes maybe about 15 minutes to do 1 ounce copper, as long as you've got enough of it to go through there. By the way, Injectorol is, where are they? They're in Comac, I think they are. Anyway, they're somewhere out near you, actually, Dick. Nice old guy runs the company. You know, they don't ship chloride through the mill because it's a what's considered to be a hazardous substance. But you can go pick up a gallon from them. I think it's like about $25, something like that. Not bad. There's a lot of other ways you can mix it up, but there's lots of possibilities. But if you go out on the web, you can get people to make your PC boards. You know, you can get two boards for like $75. If you do more, of course, price drops. Plated through hole, double-sided. If you want to go multi-layer, then it's going to cost you a little bit more, but I tend to stay away from that. I haven't actually tried to make a multi-layer board myself because, you know, you have to glue it, you have to etch it, and then trying to do the plated through holes is a real pain in the butt. But the way you can do plated through holes, you can either use stannous chloride and force that through the holes and do a chemical electroplating, and then once you've established that, you can do a real copper acid etch electroplating. Works out pretty well. I mean, there's a trick to it, because until you manage to get the holes filled properly, you can actually wind up making your holes a little bit too clogged. You've got to remember that you're going to use a drill that's a little bit bigger than the holes that you want, and you calculate the amount of current and the amount of time which will give you the correct diameter of the hole over time. K2RWK2J.
Very fine, Eric. Sounds like a lot of good suggestions there. Rich, you may need some fills on this. N2EO, go right ahead.
Hi, Dick. I'm a little bit confused because I know we're talking more about printed circuit boards. I'm wondering, is there any kind of a I put it simply this way. Is there any kind of a printer that I could buy that's not going to cost a fortune? A few hundred dollars. I know a regular printer is, what, $100-something today? It would cost me, say, $300. Could I get a printer that will allow me to print on a hard substance, like, you know, a meter face, or a front panel after being painted? And, you know, I guess it has to have a means of copying from a stencil. I'm not exactly sure what I need.
I can answer that.
I'll bet you about $10,000. I'll bet you in general the answer is no, because most of the printers that are available these days have to work on a bendable surface, like a piece of paper. Back to you, Eric.
Actually, that's incorrect. You can get from Epson a printer that actually is intended for CDs, and as long as you're within the size of the CD, they're less than $100. But the name of the company for the what you really want is Pulsar. They make these fabrication kits, and they make this stuff called polar transfer system. So you prepare your piece of metal, and with a laser printer, you run this paper through it with whatever your scale is, and accurately where the holes in the meter plate are, and so on and so forth. You line it up on you print it on this stuff, and you've got to make sure that you do it mirrored, because what happens is you take an iron, and you iron this stuff down, and then you put it in water, and basically the water releases the toner from the paper, and it stays on the hunk of metal or whatever it is that you're using, and it comes as black, and you can get foils to make it either green or white. So if you want white lettering, you put the white foil on it. If once the toner is on the metal, you lay this foil over it and heat it up again, this white stuff sticks to the toner. And if you want it to last forever, just spray it with Cryon and you're all set.
I tried that, but the paint peeled off very easily. Paint is meant to be put on plastic, not on metal, and to an ink.
Eric, what is the price of that Pulsar device that does that kind of transfer printing? Do you buy the printed object itself, or do you buy the machine that makes the printed object? Thank you, Eric.
Right, the machine that makes the printed object, is it a typical laser printer or a Xerox machine? You need a Xerox machine, anything with a toner, not an inkjet printer. It's called TTS paper. You can get a packet of 10 sheets of 8x10 for like 13, put a digital solder for $13, I've seen it cheaper than that. And you have to make sure that your surface is perfectly clean, as the other guy said, he's had trouble with it. And yes, but the other trick is that it has to be hot enough, and there has to be enough pressure for it to adhere. And once you get that done right, then you spray Cryolon over it, or some form of plastic lacquer, and it will stay permanent.
Let me ask you this question, Eric. If Rich makes his chunk of metal really clean, makes the paint adhere with a hot enough iron, and then protects it with a Cryolon spray, in a well-protected environment, underneath the glass of a Dawson valve meter movement, no sweat. The next step, I think, Rich maybe is going to ask is there a way you know of making a surface like that tough enough that he could use it as silk screening, so to speak, poor man's silk screening, on the front panel of his central electronics or Collins equipment? Do you believe it's possible to make it adhere that well? Could you spray something on top of it to make it tough enough to act as a front panel? Over to you, Eric.
Yes, you can. You really can if you do it right. And it takes a little practice. It's not something done easily. But if you don't mind spending a couple of dollars, there's quite a few companies that will make you a custom panel for like under $50 or something that's smaller than 10 inches square. But my preference for making panels, I like to go and etch it. Nothing better than etching it, because you're actually removing some of the metal surface. You can then use various different kinds of paint. You can anodize it if you want, and make those letters really stand out. You don't have to etch it very deep. You can etch it maybe, a 10,000th of an inch, 5,000th of an inch is deep enough. And you've got something that'll last a lifetime. And of course, I mean, if you're going to bang it up, just scratch it up, and it's like anything else.
If you were rich, would you have the various companies that can do that work redo the front panel he now has, or do you think you'd have them build a brand new front panel where he gives them a Gerber file with all the dimensions for where the holes are and where the etching goes? Over to you, Eric.
All right. Well, I've not considered, repairing, like if it's Rich we're talking about, he's probably talking about a Collins something. There's enough guys out there that either actually remanufacture Oshma panel, you're going to pay for it. But if you want to do it yourself, I don't know how I'd really want to answer that, because that's a tough call. I mean, when you're designing something of your own, and you're making your own layout, that's one thing. And you can deal with materials that are available, you can deal with simple shapes and stuff like that. If you want to refurbish your columns, then I suspect the guys that actually do this, what they probably do is they have a silk screen made up, and they do it the good old hand method with the silk screen and ink, and you know, you take the front panel and you dump it in an acid bath and clean it up, and then re-anodize it or whatever the original paint color is, and then silk screen the front back on. As you consider that most of the stuff done in those days were done strictly by silk screen, that's why they wear off, so. You know, there's nothing to stop you from doing that, but, you know, if you're not doing dozens of them, I don't think it's worth the effort.
Understand. Back to you, Rich. You may have some more questions for these guys.
No, and I got some basic information. The meters, I think, can be done probably with some kind of a printer or... I'm a little bit confused. A lot of information was thrown at me. So let me digest this. I do want to do the meters, and I'm, so I know what Eric is saying. There are people doing Collins faces. There are people doing some of the Johnson faces. But for instance, I restored this little Q-multiplier by Central Electronics, and nobody's doing that. It wouldn't pay... for what, you know, I mean, that's like an oddball piece of equipment. It would be nice to be able to do these oddball pieces of equipment and not be dependent on somebody else. Well, the panel gets scratched, not have to touch it up because I don't have the equipment to re-screen it. Anyway, I'm going to do some more checking around. Back to you, Dick. K2LIW and 2EO.
My personal opinion.
Yeah, go ahead, Alex.
Many years of experience. Go to the PCB route and don't worry about anything. You give them the Gerber file and you get the finite product. Well, that's my opinion. Answer any.
Yeah, they do it with...
KTY, I got one other idea.
Mel recognized. I bet you they do it with better than a thousandth of an inch of accuracy there, Alex. And just to give one little bit of clarity here, Rich, what... Eric was telling you about the Pulsar company, is this is a Pulsar transfer film, I'm going to call it, which you print in reverse, mirror image of the mirror face that you want, of a meter face you want. You do it backwards, what you would see in a mirror. And when you look at it, you've got a sheet of backwards writing. You put the backwards writing of the sheet in your hand onto the metal of the meter face, iron it on, dissolve it away with water or whatever, the paper backing, and now the lettering is properly on your piece of metal, and then spray some kind of protective coating on top. So it's a transfer process of a flexible sheet of film, which is printed in mirror image. That's one of the processes that Eric was telling us about. K2KEY. Go ahead, Mel. K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. When you look back at the old vintage equipment, you'll notice that the printing that's on the panels, like the tape, I restored here a Helicrafted, and the printing was slightly, you can feel it, you know, the original printing was slightly raised. I had one or two indications on the panel that were really rubbed off from just, you know, rubbing the finger over that, using that knob a lot. Just, you know, your finger rubs against the printing and removed it. I found at that time that they used a printing on their black, Helicraft was basically a black panel they had on their early receivers, that printing was basically a white printing that was basically almost exactly the same as this company called Datak, D-A-T-A-K, used to sell in these sheets. I bought a lot of those sheets, but I did a lot of paneling. Most of it came out extremely well. You know, where you have to, you lay the lettering on the panel, you lay the sheet on the panel, and it's got the white material on one side, and it comes with a number of different colors. And you rub it, with the back of a racer and all, and it transferred to the panel. You have to do it very careful and all. I found some tricks on how to do that. And then you spray it over with some lacquer or whatever and make it permanent. And I noticed it's extremely, I think, almost impossible to tell from the original printing. I have a feeling most likely it was similar to what they were doing back in those days, Dick, over.
Okay, that sounds good. Anyone have any other suggestions for refurbishing front panels and meter faces? Give us your call letters right now, K2RIW.
By the way, Daytac is still in business in Rockwell, Illinois, and they still make that stuff. And most of those panels that you can look over were originally silk screen, so, you know, it winds up being raised ink, so to speak.
Two we go, Dick.
Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Mel's idea is taken. I have some two receivers from the 1930s and 40s. One is an S-22, the other is an S-22R. And Mel is right. On those receivers, that's almost exactly like the Daytac. I did those, oh, I guess maybe 15 years ago. What I did was I resprayed them and pulled a very thin piece of drafting tape across it to get a straight line, and then re-glinted with the Daytac and shot it with clear lacquer, and they came out good. But once you get into the 50s and 60s, for instance, I'm looking at an E.F. Johnson Ranger 2 here. Fortunately for me, this particular panel is in very good shape. But things like the, I don't know if you remember what it looked like, the E.F. Johnson logo, you could not do that with Daytac or the circular slide rule dial. And it's multicolored. This is the Ranger 2, so it's a light gray and sort of a dark gray. Those paints can be matched, but as far as getting the logo and everything back, see what I want, maybe I didn't make it real clear. What I'd like to be able to do is take a scratch panel, make a stencil of the actual panel before disturbing it with the Johnson logo and the lettering and all that, with the type of lettering which would be in there and its relative space to everything else. Make a stencil, then re-spray the panel and put the stenciling back. You follow, Dick?
Yeah, that sounds like a tough process. Anyone have any further suggestions to Rich on what he's now describing? Give us a call. Give me your call letters right now. Yeah, I'm not quite sure I understand what you're saying. When you make a stencil of the original panel, refurbish the panel, and then put the stencil back on, I'm wondering how you're doing that transfer process into the thing that you're calling stencil. I didn't quite understand that one, Rich. Go ahead.
Okay, maybe I'm using wrong terminology. What I'm getting at is a lot of these panels have scratches, but most of the lettering is intact. So the idea would be to either photographically, to make a stencil. In other words, a master, call it a master, of the original panel, and then take the panel down to the bare metal and re-spray it. Now, spraying is not a big deal. An airbrush and matching the paint in a good paint store or even an automobile supply house can match paint. But then take that what I call stencil or master and use that to put the lettering back after the paneling has been repainted. It should be able to be done because, I mean, Johnson Columns, Central Electronics, all these companies had logos and they put it on 50 years ago. If it could be put on then with the technology they had now, then it should be easier to do it today.
Hi, Mr. Johnson.
Go ahead, Eric.
Drag your rear end over to film paint. Get yourself a silk screen box and get yourself the photographic film. Take a picture with a 4x5 or an 8x10 so that way you don't have any spherical aberrations from a small aperture camera. And you take and make your original photograph, clean it up, make yourself on the stencil film, the stencil, which is, by the way, reversed, so that way the ink passes through where you should have your lettering.
line it up carefully on your panel that you've already cleaned up and put your black surface or whatever the back surface is. Line it up properly under your stencil. Take your squeegee, take whatever color ink you want, and put it back on.
Hey, it's that easy. What is the name of this place you told me to get over to?
The largest art supply place in the United States, Pearl Paint.
Now give us, say that slowly, phonetically, and spell it out, and what count is it in, Eric, and roughly what would the service cost? Over to you, Eric.
Pearl, as in pearls, as in oysters, P-E-R-A-L, Papa Radio, Edwards, Alpha, Lima.
Okay, Pearls is located in what town?
One of the biggest stores is in Manhattan, but they have stores everywhere. There's one next to, if you're on the island, there's a big one right next to Micro Center. There's one in Manhattan. There's one, they're all over the place.
Okay, Eric, you said Pearls Art Supply. I'll look it up. Do you happen to know where in Manhattan?
It's in the Miracle Mile, but I'm not sure they have the silkscreen material, but they can get it for you. Look up in the phone book, all over it, but the big one is in, what street is it? It's on, I forget, it's somewhere downtown. I can ask my artist friend here, and she can tell me.
I know where they are in Brooklyn.
Go ahead and tell us.
They're on Dolphin Avenue. They got another annex of a big place of art stuff. Amazing stuff there. I've been there a number of times. It's Dolphin Avenue and Avenue H, I believe it is. I don't know the phone number and all offhand. I have to look for it and everything, but I'm sure you could easily look it up or get telephone number, but I know it's on Nostrid Avenue, and I believe it's Avenue H, or I, or J. Which one is it? Avenue H. Almost positive it's Avenue H and Nostrid Avenue take over.
The big one is on Canal Street, just west of Broadway.
It's another one.
I'm amazed Canal Street still exists, considering that whole area was drastically modified by way of the World Trade Center. Okay, anyone have any further questions or information on this particular subject? Give me a call at us right now.
He asked about like local, like Johnson and all, Dick. This is KQKUY. I can tell him I think I have an answer for him on those logos, over.
Give it to us right now, Rich. I mean, Mel, go ahead.
I remember I've seen a couple of websites where these guys that are collecting Johnson and all that stuff, whether it's still available, they had on some of the, actually that logo that was put on like E.F. Johnson, that was actually pasted on. They had a method in those days, the logo, in other words, they put it on, rub it or some goddamn thing, and peel off the, was like a scotch tape. That's how it was put on those panels, believe it or not. I had seen there was a couple of manufacturers here in Brooklyn that made radio equipment years ago. I had some of those different logos. I didn't have to have them for Johnson, but for a couple of others. They gave me a couple of labels if I ever wanted to replace the label. It was like a scotch tape that they put on, and they basically just ran the thing over it, and it transferred over onto the panel, and they peeled it off, Dick, over.
Sounds like a possible way to go. Alrighty. Any further fills for now, or you think that'll do it, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW.
No, thank you very much, everybody who gave me input on that. I got a good idea now what I'm going to do. I think the silk screening pearls art supply is probably the way to go. At least that's the way I think now it's the way to go. And I'm probably the meters could be done With that too, a photographic Mesa method making a silkscreen. Dick, thank you very much. K2RIW and the TechNet from a happy customer and 2EO.
Oh yeah, one more thing, Dick. This is K2KEY. Just remembered something else.
Go ahead, Rich. I mean, Melt.
Hey, I don't know if they still have it available, but they had something for copy. For instance, you had to copy something off a panel. Now, what it was is like almost like a fingerprinting process. You had something you sprayed on. You put this piece of material on top of it, and you rubbed it, and it transferred like a fingerprint would be transferred onto the piece of material, and then you could like you do fingerprinting. They inked it, and depending on what color you ink, and you could transfer it. Basically, that's what it was for copying. What the heck was it for copying? What were they showing you? I think they showed a demonstration of copying something off of information, but it was basically done, if you could visualize how a fingerprint gets over.
Sounds like fun. Sounds like we've got to investigate this a little bit further. Obviously, we'll be discussing this more with you next week, Rich. The next person on the list was Bob, W2OSR. And, Robert, what's new in your neighborhood? K2RIW in the TechNet.
One more quickly.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I just did a quick search on the internet, and there's a company called Z Communication Company. They have replacement panels and knobs for cars 75, A1, A2, A3, A4, 32S1s, EF Johnson, reconditioned knobs, replacing white inserts. Anyway, what I see out there is a bunch of them. Do a bunch of searches. Maybe you can find one that is in your price range.
What's the name again, Eric? Did you say Z or C Communications?
Z as in zebra. The guy's name is Glenn E. Zook, K9STH. He's in Richardson, Texas.
Okay, I'll take a look. Thank you, and 2EO.
One more thing, Dick, K2KEY. I thought of another thing.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, let's say you wanted a Johnson logo. What you can do is look back in a lot of the old magazines, and you'll find one of their advertisements with the picture of the logo, the Viking guy. That's the way their logo was. A picture of the Viking guy, which you can scan into a computer and make yourself a picture of it, blow it up and do whatever you want. But you'll have it right in, you know, pull it out of one of those old magazines, go to any old USBs or whatever, and you'll find the Johnson logo easily, Rich, over.
Just go on the internet. I've seen like a couple of them in the past couple of seconds, so you just lots of pictures.
Okay, well, those are some good suggestions. Very good. Thank you, everybody.
Hey, the man's going to have some real pretty-looking Collins and Central Electronics and Hallicrafters equipment. He's going to have a museum there in Whitestone. Okay, Mr. Secretary, Robert, how are they treating you in Glen Cove? W2OSR, K2RIW.
Well, Dick, I think I'm in trouble with my wife. We're supposed to do the dishes at 8 o'clock. I'm just waiting to get on here, but all right, W2OSR. Just wanted to know if the call sign NQ Bravo Bravo or the name Bob Harden bring a bell with you.
Now, N2 Bravo Bravo. I'm looking him up right now, and I don't think it does. We'll soon see if Robert Martin, Port Jefferson. I went to Port Jefferson High School, graduated there in 1958, and I was second in command of the so-called radio club, which wasn't super active at that time. And I don't recognize him. I wish it would have his... Oh, yes, I see the date he's born. He's not contemporary with me, so I'm having trouble with this one. Now, Bob, go ahead.
Okay, well, Bob's living in... living on the Isle of Man. anyway, he said he used to participate in the Weimar Tech Fest way back when it was somehow in conjunction with the IEEE, and was kind enough to send me a copy of a talk he gave on the tech net way back when.
Wow. Okay. He's 7 years younger than me. QIZ.com does not tell us his previous call letters, so therefore I'm not able to pin him down that way. I don't recognize N2 Bravo Bravo. Isle of Man, used to live in Port Jefferson, and I see his license is good up until 2017. And you say he gave a presentation on the TechMaster. Interesting, because we've had very few presentations. Mel has given a couple presentations on things like the Smith chart. I've given a couple of informal, almost, presentations on the subject of antennas. So I'm a little confused by this, although the thing has been around for 25 years, and my memory only goes back a couple of years. So I haven't the biggest idea what happened before that, though, Bob. Over to you, Bob.
Okay, well, it may have been before your time, Dick. I'm not sure. In any case, what I'll do is I'll back up a copy of it and send it to you. Not too relevant today. It goes back to the early days of local area networks.
Okay, there are local area networks. And by the way, after we go through our questions, we're going to be discussing this brand new thing called, what the heck's the word they get, the coin for it, which means... Wi-tricity, Wi-Fi and electricity. In other words, methods of wirelessly sending power to pieces of electronics is something that's being advocated. And there are people who are alarmed by this because they think it's the next thing after broadband of a power line that's going to start giving us some grief. I'm not worried yet. I think broadband of a power line, because of its economics, is going to die a natural death. On top of that, the suit recently brought by the ARRL against the FCC on this one. ARRL is essentially successful in bringing their lawsuit. So I think BPL is almost going to go away, is my impression. And this new thing that's coming along, I don't think it's anywhere near as bad as broadband of a power line. Broadband of a power line is actually going to make all of your LUCO and LIPA and Con Ed wiring into an antenna, radiating high-speed data. Whoa, my goodness, can that create slow-speed data, lousy interference, lousy security, and an awful lot of grief, and a costly process without anywhere near enough bandwidth. We all want megabytes of bandwidth these days. Only fiber can supply that, is an opinion of mine. Okay, the next person who signed in with a question was Joe from H-O-R-Y-Y. Hope we've been giving you enough delay tonight so you haven't been experiencing internet dropout. And one other quick question, Joe. I should know, when you get a chance, give us a few words on how a person can be listening to the TechNet by way of internet. If, say, for instance, he was a long distance away and he was foolish enough to think that he wants to listen to this live, give us some words on how a person would do that. From H-U-R-Y-Y, H-U-R-Y-W in the TechNet.
H-W-W
with
info.
Yes, sir.
Okay,
are we recognized? But Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
All right. The internet connection here is called IRLT. It only allows people who have an IRLT node to connect to the reflector, which your two repeaters are connected to. I believe your Glen Oaks repeater also has EchoLink installed in it, and that would enable people with a PC and the proper operating software with EchoLink to be able to tune in to your TechNet over the internet. Does that answer your question?
Just about, but go ahead with your question, Joe.
Give me a minute, please.
Okay, go ahead, Howie.
WB2HWW.com. I am streaming the TechNet live over the internet, no special software, real one player, or any media player will work.
For a person who signs into WB2HWW.com and properly scans through his website, your website would be able to listen to the TechNet live, is what I think you're saying, Howie. Did I get that correct?
So far, almost every night or every week, I've been putting my repeats in here I stream my repeater audio stream 24/7. All you do is go to my website, the WB2HWW.com. As soon as you go to the website, as soon as it loads, it automatically starts playing. So right now, there's about 8 people listening to the TetNet. There's a guy in California. There's also I also know there's guys on Canadians, because this is also going out over 2966. So it's going out over many, many ways. There's also another guy doing it, W2LIR or W2LIC. There's another guy who has the Scanner Club, and he's also streaming it. So there's a couple of places that are being, that are listening to this repeater and streaming it over the Internet. I'm one of them. Go ahead.
Okay, fascinating. You've got an audience. Go ahead with your question, Joe.
Well, I have a question and a comment. I guess I'll try the comment first, because the comment is reference to the question I asked last week with the problem with the R7000. Do you remember that?
Sure do, and I got quite a few pieces of information on that one. Various people are convinced that as you add padding to an R7000, the voltage that sometimes exists on the semiconductor of that cable is being changed. That's a factor. But still, I believe from what you were measuring, when you added the pad and the intermod essentially disappeared, it would suggest that the R7000 in the non-operating mode is a catalyst, is a nonlinear termination on that particular disc cone antenna, which allowed all the signals that are being applied to that antenna simultaneously to be mixed together in various techniques, various ways. And any nearby receiver is very sensitive to those re-emissions after that mixing process. That's my hypothesis. Over to you, Joe.
The problem completely comes out of the R7000. It has nothing to do with the antenna whatsoever. And how I prove this out is the first thing I did was measure the signal pole coming in from the disco net to test my repeater, emanating on about 448 megahertz. I got a reading of plus 12 dBm. So I figured out a way of hooking the R7000 up to a generator with a 50 dB tap to be able to look at the signal going in and coming out at the same time with an analyzer with a preamp on. At plus 12, it generates spurs at 434, comes out at minus 2. At 420, it's minus 14. 405, 406 is minus 32. As I drop the generator level down to plus 10, all the spurs stop completely. At plus 11, I get an AM modulated type of signal at 434 megahertz, like 6,300 hertz modulation on it. There's something that's not plugged in. This is very strange. So that's what I found out about the R7000.
Okay, the high power level signal generator you're putting into the R7000, I am guessing, is forward biasing that first emitter base junction of the first RF transistor, allowing it to go into its nonlinear mode. So you were able to do it with a signal generator. With your disc cone antenna and nearby strong signals, they are also biasing it in the forward mode. Is that a possible explanation, Joe? Go ahead.
No, because I did this with just test equipment, completely disconnecting the radio from the antenna. The antenna has nothing to do with the equipment problem, coming totally out of the equipment itself.
Okay, you misunderstood me. I'm not saying the antenna is causing it. I'm saying the antenna, the disc cone, is an extremely broadband antenna, allowing many signals to be applied to the R7000 simultaneously. When one of the many signals applied to the R7000 is a strong signal, it has enough strength to overcome the 2/10 or 3/10 of a volt of emitter base junction strikeover voltage, let's call it, where the first transistor goes into the conduct mode, nonlinear diode emitter base junction. So if there is a signal applied to the R7000, particularly a group of signals, but if one of the signals is strong enough, he's going to make harmonics of that signal, he's going to make intermods of multiple signals if they're present. You're still saying you think that is not happening, Joe? And if so, what do you believe is happening?
Well, that probably is happening, but I've never seen signals move in frequency as you change the level. As the level changes slightly from 12 to plus 13 to plus 14, the spurs actually change frequency from where they actually are. They're not fixed at one particular point. As the level goes to plus 10, they all disappear. So would a diode be able to change the frequency of the spurs also?
A simple diode, no. But there's a hell of a lot of other circuitry in the R7000. I guess there's even a slim possibility that you put a strong enough signal in, you're on each half cycle supplying a big enough voltage to not only forward bias the emitter base junction, but supply enough voltage between the collector and emitter junction to start making that first transistor active, and then can it break into an oscillation. You've already discovered that lowering the signal level by just a very small amount by putting an attenuator makes the effect go away. I know you're discovering that the R7000 is the only thing that's doing it. You were fairly sure that when the R7000 was doing it, not only was it turned off by the front panel, but to be double darn sure, I think you unplugged it to make sure that none of the power supplies were active, but yet it still was able to do it. And so it's a bit of a mystery. It looks like you've narrowed it down to the R7000. Now the mechanism by which the front end of that radio can do it is something to look at much further. The owner's manual, I believe, supplies you with a schematic. When you stare at that schematic, I wonder if it gave you any hints, Joe. I mean, K2RYY, K2RYW.
K2HWW with a comment on this subject. HWW with a comment on this subject.
Okay. How we recognize Joe first, and then how we met order. Go ahead, Joe.
All right, I'm not going to beep this to death anymore. I mean, the problem is the problem. There's nothing I can do about it. I'm aware of the problem, and that's all there is to it. It could happen to anybody. You could live next to, close by FM broadcast station, and have, or anything else, and have something come to the antenna of this thing, overload, and cause you other griefs that you're not even totally aware of. It's not just coming from an amateur transmitter that's located at this location. There'd be other things doing it too. Just want to make people aware if they have this kind of receiver that it can be doing this kind of problem.
You have to admit, though, Joe, you're putting an unusual signal strength into that receiver. The average receiver is working on signals of microvolts. When you put in 0 dBm, which is hundreds of millivolts, and now you're going to plus 10 and plus 20 dBm, which is approaching 10 and 100 milliwatts, you're putting extremely unusual signal strength levels into that receiver. Many a receiver with a signal that strong, which is approximately 120 decibels above threshold. You take any piece of sensitive receiving equipment and you put in signals that strong. You do a big enough investigation, and I'll bet you'll find out 30% of all those pieces of equipment will give you some wild responses. I'm back to you for an answer on that one, Joe.
You're absolutely right, and when you live in a place like New York City, when you get transmitters all over the place, anything is possible. That's enough as far as this one goes. Now I have an actual question on a piece of tech equipment. Ready for this one?
Before we go there, on the previous subject, Howie had a comment. Go ahead, Howie.
Comment is, it's not the first RF amplifier. I think that's a MOSFET or a gas set. It's the diode. They have a lot of switching diodes in there. Switching things in and out, and they all have proactive tuning. They have a bunch of dials, and when you reverse bias those dials, they may be changing patterns, and it may be causing some kind of multi network to create oscillation. That's what happened. I had the same issue with the R7000 many years ago. I brought it up to the site, and if you really start pumping signals into that thing, the R7000 will create problems. Dick, H2RAW, WD2HWW.
I would comment.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this reminds me of basically of back when television came into existence, and they had a lot of problems. People would fool around with the antenna in the back of their television, and sometimes they took off one lead of the twin lead, of the 300 ohm twin lead, and that would create a problem of the oscillator coming back up the antenna line and creating a problem of actually of TBI. I remember we had one where I lived, and I got blamed for a lot of it, that it was a combination of when their television set was on channel 7, I think, it knocked out all the televisions in the area that were on channel 11, simply because they didn't understand why there was grid lead on the tuners of those days over 6.
I can remember on a number of the customers I used to have when I did television repair back in the late 50s, where a single antenna on the roof with twin lead coming down with some kind of a flaky splitter, sometimes just tying another piece of twin lead in parallel, where you were feeding two television sets from a single antenna without any isolation of any kind, no real hybrid, just direct connection with T connection of twin lead. And that 7-11 combination, one set on channel 7, the other set trying to watch channel 11, the local oscillator of one would be jamming the other, putting herringbones on the screen or making no reception at all. So in the early days, the local oscillator radiation of the tuner front end of television sets was a reasonably strong signal. The FCC has put some stricter rules on that as to how much local oscillator re-emission is now allowed, and so better shielding and more unilateral RF amplifiers and things like that are now in practice. So some of that has gone away. However, this R7000 thing is a beautiful piece of proof of one thing, and that is when you bring any kind of extremely sensitive receiving equipment into an extremely high-power signal-rich environment, like the top of a building that's got the 10 or 15 repeater stick antennas on it, if you don't have a darn good set of filters on the front end of your receiver, and in the most extreme case, you may have to put the darn receiver into a shielded box with shielded coax connectors going into the box so that you can stop the re-radiation through the case of the box itself, the signal ingress by way of the case. You may have to do drastic things like that when you're working in an environment where there are signals 90, 100, 110, and more decibels above threshold of the receiver. You've got to filter out everything except the signal you're looking for. That's essentially what goes on with a good repeater with that duplexing filter. You study what that duplexing filter is doing, and you'll rapidly recognize the fact that it's an extremely high technology, 4 or 6 cavity thing that creates 120 decibels of isolation between the transmitter and receiver that are sharing the same antenna,